sorts of valuable information about the children's families, schooling, and activities. He recorded how many books were in their houses, how active they were in their playtime, and how happy their parents' marriages were. He measured their personalities. Were they prudent, extroverted, cheerful? He then followed his participants as they grew up, made career choices, and had families of their own. When he launched the study in 1921, Dr. Terman was in his mid-40s. He died in 1956, but the project continued, carried on by others. We began serious work on this study in 1990, and so often use the phrases our study or our project when talking about analyses, findings, and interpretations. But this is not in any way intended to ignore or minimize the tremendous debt we all owe to Dr. Terman, to his collaborators, and to the Terman participants and their families. Social support and long life. To determine which aspects of social ties were prominent on the path to long life, we examined how the various aspects of social support, at around retirement age, were related to mortality risk over the ensuing 2 decades. We figure that if a Terman participant sincerely felt that he or she had friends and relatives to count on when having a hard time, then that person would be healthier. Those who felt very loved and cared for, we predicted, would live the longest. Surprise, our prediction was wrong. Although other studies have shown that people who feel loved and cared for will report a better sense of well-being, they feel better, we did not find that it helped much for living a long life. What about focusing on the size of social networks rather than emphasizing only feelings? Does having regular contact with a large number of close, comfortable friends make a difference? A clear finding was that those who had a large social network lived longer. Just as we had seen in our studies of religiosity, social networks matter a lot. Beyond social network size, the clearest benefit of social relationships came from helping others. Those who helped their friends and neighbors, advising and caring for others, tended to live to old age. Those like Barbara, who had large networks and good social relations because they helped others, were reaping a real benefit in terms of their longevity. We saw again and again that it was not the feel-good aspects of having friends that was associated with long life. Rather, it was the more hands-on pieces that mattered most, being in contact with family members, doing things with friends, and helping others. When taken in total, with the many other characteristics of long life, being conscientious, being in a good marriage, having healthy habits, and working hard in a successful career, Defoe's adage really crumbles. While his catchy saying has become a truism, repeated endlessly over the years in movies, songs, and philosophies, there's no real evidence that the good die young. In fact, although there are always some exceptions, which are therefore notable, generally speaking, it's the good ones who can actually help shape their fate. The bad die early, and the good do great. Our findings suggest that someone who scores lots of points from feeling religious or from watching television evangelists will not likely have the same experiences or positive outcomes as someone who is actively engaged in a religious community. For the Terman men, and often for men more generally, the relevance of religion to health is overwhelmed by other influences, their families, and their careers. The Terman men relied more on their wives in social realms, and so religious ties were less important to their health. And those unmarried but healthy men like John, who was not at all religious in the traditional sense, yet still lived a long life, usually maintained close relationships with friends and colleagues outside the context of religious organizations. Some people feel they are not devout enough, and they resolve to meditate further or to spend more hours in prayer. While this makes many people feel better and more compassionate, our findings suggest that these practices are not central to health promotion. Instead, the good health habits fostered by religious practice and especially the social engagement that is so much a part of religious community, are the likely explanations for the health of many religious folks. Are pets truly substitute friends?
So I also want to cut in here and just talk about Longevity Project. This study was done over 78 years, and it's pretty old. Some of the ideas about how men live back then have probably changed to how men live nowadays. So some of it's maybe slightly outdated, but it is one of the largest social studies on the effects of sociability on human life. So I think it's still a valid study, but I just wanted to cut in and talk about that. So let's get right back into it.
Animals often provide their owners with love, purpose, and security. Some researchers even suggest that pets are a good substitute for human companionship. It's true that animals can encourage healthy behaviors. When you take your dog for a daily walk, you are also getting a walk. And they encourage a degree of responsibility and organization. As pet owners and fans, we weren't about to argue a broad case against the benefits of having pets, but over the long term, we wanted to see whether regularly interacting with pets produced measurable health benefits for the determined participants. In 1977, when they were in their 60s, the subjects were asked how often they played with their pets. Never, seldom, occasionally, or frequently. This was the perfect question because we didn't care if someone had a pet but never interacted with that pet. Using this question and the long life data, we looked to see whether those who played more with pets were more likely to survive over the next 14 years. Another surprise. They were not. Not at all. Perhaps many of these pet aficionados already had good social support from people, meaning that animal companionship had little to add. If this were true, playing with pets would not be important for the group as a whole, but it might be quite important for those who were socially isolated. For them, pets could be filling in the gap that would otherwise be filled with people. We ran these statistical analyses again, this time looking just at the socially isolated, but the results were the same. Playing with pets wasn't associated with longer life. We had to conclude that urging your elderly aunt, who really doesn't like animals, to get a dog so she will have a health-promoting companion is probably not a worthwhile idea. Having a pet is great if it brings joy to your life, but we found no evidence that it will provide the social enrichment that is so important to long life. What it means for you. Guideposts to health and long life. The lives of the determined participants showed that taking time to cultivate social networks is important, not just to the quality of life, but also to its quantity. Feeling good, staying calm, and breathing deeply can be signs of health, but they are not its root causes. Instead, social relations should be the first place to look for improving health and longevity. You may recall from the last chapter that John was not a religious person. Yet, he lived a long life, and his social ties were a big part of his secret. For John, becoming more religious would not likely have improved his longevity, because he was already enjoying the strongest benefits of being religious, the social elements. In contrast, Donna's case is one where congregational life could have made a huge difference. Donna didn't spend much time with friends or colleagues, focusing instead on raising her sons and just getting by after her divorce. When her sons were grown, Donna pretty much quit going to church and became even more socially isolated. If Donna had instead become more involved in her church or some other meaningful organizations, using her considerable intelligence to join with others to make a difference in her community, it very well might have improved her prospects for a long life. John and Barbara found social connections in their careers. Barbara maintained additional social links through her congregation and extended network of friends. Linda's ties were mostly through family and church groups, but the effect remained the same. It was not those who felt the most connected and appreciated, but those who had many actual ties in their social networks, and who were engaged with helping others, who lived longest. It is worth reiterating that social networks represent an important, perhaps the most important, way to change one's life pathway. In many ways, it is also a very doable fix, in a relatively straightforward manner. Repairing a troubled marriage or unproductive career is also very important to health, but is quite difficult and will take a lot of time. In contrast, setting aside a few hours each week to volunteer or joining a group that shares one of your passions increases the size of your social network and provides opportunities to help others. You're never too old, and it's never too late or too early to start this, and the returns can be enormous in terms of life's quality and quantity. The Road to Resilience. The highly successful Hollywood director, Edward Dmytryk, one of the hardest-working Terman subjects, led one of the most stressful lives but lived to age 90. Those who cared about others, who were agreeable but not necessarily sociable, often thrived even in the face of adversity. Like Dmytryk, they sought out the best in others, which was a key road to resilience. The same could be said of those children who faced the divorce of their parents. Those who got back on track with a sense of accomplishment in their careers and a happy marriage of their own lived long lives. We didn't find that competition and drive are unhealthy characteristics. On the contrary, those who were the most disappointed with their achievements died the youngest. It would be naive to think that successful Hollywood directors like Dmytryk, TV writers like Jess Oppenheimer, and the like, cannot compete and throw an elbow at their opponent if needed. But they had the persistence, the motivation, and especially the support of a spouse or a close friend to come back each time they faced a challenge. Resilience was not a trait they were born with, nor an inner insight, but a process of perseverance and hard work. The persistent, consequential, and social life. The 1,528 Terman participants were all quite intelligent, with a good start in life. By age 10, they were doing well in school, were noticed by their teachers, and were being investigated by a Stanford professor, Lewis Terman. Many went on to be successful, but quite a large number of their fellow participants faced regular disappointments in love, in careers, and in length of life. Some who succeeded were lucky, but many others made their own luck. Across the lifespan, many predictors emerged as to who would do better and who would do worse, who would live longer and who would die younger. It was not good cheer or being popular and outgoing that made the difference. It was also not those who took life easy, played it safe, or avoided stress who lived the longest. Rather, it was those who, through an often complex pattern of persistence, prudence, hard work, and close involvement with friends and communities, headed down meaningful, interesting life paths, and as we have illustrated, found their way back to these healthy paths each time they were pushed off the road. But having a large social network, engaging in physical activities that naturally draw you in, giving back to your community, enjoying and thriving in your career, and nurturing a healthy marriage or close friendships can do more than add many years to your life. Together, they represent the living with purpose that comes from working hard, reaching out to others, and bouncing back from difficult times. How fascinating to understand that those individuals who became involved with others in a consequential life would be improving their health as an unanticipated bonus.
So that was just an excerpt from the Longevity Project. That's a 2011 book by Howard S. Freeman and Leslie R. Martin. Definitely worth checking out if you're interested in sociology and psychology. It's a longish book talking about basically that project that lasted for a very long time, 60 years plus. So we're moving on to a little snippet about game theory. So there's going to be a little snippet from Robert Sapolsky on his talk about behavioral evolution at Stanford University from 2010, and a little snippet from Veritasium where he talks about it a little bit further. But basically, it goes into detail talking about game theory in general. And maybe the gist of the outline is, even in game theory, in the very fundamental pieces, the basic building blocks of interactions between humans, working together has long-term positive effects, even in the base building blocks of how even like a computer program operates. So it's a very interesting little snippet. So let's get into it. A little bit of Veritasium, a little bit of Robert Sapolsky from Stanford University. It's about 6 minutes long, so keep on listening.
Prisoner's dilemma. Two individuals are prisoners and they escape, and they're both captured and they're interrogated separately. And if both of them refuse to talk, that's great for them. If they both squeal, they both get punished. If one of them is able to squeal on the other one, they get a great reward. If the other one, what you get formally are four possible outcomes. Both individuals cooperate. Both individuals cheat against each other. Individual A cooperates and B cheats. Individual B cooperates and A cheats. And what you get in Prisoner's Dilemma is a formal payoff for each. What gives you the greatest payoff? Stabbing the other guy in the back. You cheat and they cooperate. You have exploited them. You have taken advantage of them. Isn't that wonderful? That's the highest payoff in Prisoner Dilemma games. Second highest payoff, you both cooperate. Third highest payoff, which is beginning to not count as a payoff, but in a lot of the games is set up as the start of punishment, both of you cheat on each other. Fourth worst possible payoff is you're the sucker, you cooperate, and the other individual stabs you in the back. So what the Prisoner's Dilemma game is, set up these circumstances where individuals will play versions of this against each other with varying rewards and that sort of thing and parameters that we will look at in a lot of detail, and seeing when is it optimal to cooperate, when is it optimal to cheat.
Axelrod found that all the best performing strategies, including Tit for Tat, shared four qualities. First, they were all nice, which just means they are not the first to defect. So Tit for Tat is a nice strategy. It can defect, but only in retaliation. The opposite of nice is nasty. That's a strategy that defects first. So Joss is nasty. Out of the 15 strategies in the tournament, 8 were nice and 7 nasty. The top 8 strategies were all nice. And even the worst performing nice strategy still far outscored the best performing nasty one. The second important quality was being forgiving. A forgiving strategy is one that can retaliate, but it doesn't hold a grudge. So Tit for Tat is a forgiving strategy. It retaliates when its opponent defects, but it doesn't let defections from before the last round influence its current decisions. Friedman, on the other hand, is maximally unforgiving.
After the first defection, just from the opponent, would defect for the rest of the game. Okay, that's it. No mercy. And that might feel good to do, but it doesn't end up working out well in the long run.
This conclusion, that it pays to be nice and forgiving, came as a shock to the experts. Many had tried to be tricky and create subtle, nasty strategies to beat their opponent and eke out an advantage. But they all failed. Instead, in this tournament, nice guys finished first. Now, Tit for Tat is quite forgiving, but it's possible to be even more forgiving. Axelrod's sample strategy only defects after its opponent defected twice in a row. It was Tit for Two Tats. Now, that might sound overly generous, but when Axelrod ran the numbers, he found that if anyone had submitted the sample strategy, they would have won the tournament. So he ran a simulation where successful strategies in one generation would see their numbers grow, and unsuccessful ones would see their numbers drop. In this simulation, the worst performing strategies quickly shrink and go extinct, while the top performing strategies become more common. Harrington, the only nasty strategy in the top 15, first grew quickly, but then as the strategies it was preying on went extinct, Harrington's numbers also quickly dropped. This shows a main benefit of this simulation, because it tests how well a strategy does with other successful strategies. After 1,000 generations, the proportions are mostly stable, and only nice strategies survive. Again, tit for tat comes out on top, representing 14.5% of the total population. Now, this process may sound similar to evolution, but there is a subtle difference, which is that in this case there are no mutations, so it's actually an ecological simulation.
My favorite example is tit for tat does really well, but it could never do better than the player it's playing with.
I mean, think about it. By design, all they can do is lose or draw. And yet, when the results of all interactions are tallied up, they come out ahead of all other strategies. Similarly, always defect can never lose a game. It can only draw or win. But overall, it performs extremely poorly. This highlights a common misconception. Because for many people, when they think about winning, they think they need to beat the other person. In games like chess or poker, this is true, since one person's gain is necessarily another person's loss, so these games are zero-sum. But most of life is not zero-sum. To win, you don't need to get your reward from the other player. Instead, you can get it from the banker. Only in real life, the banker is the world. It is literally everything around you. It is just up to us to find those win-win situations and then work together to unlock those rewards.
Einstein's greatest intellectual stimulation came.
So that's a little snippet from a lecture done by Robert Sapkowski and Veritasium, talking about game theory. Basically, I kind of laid out what the gist was. Cooperation in game theory usually works out, and when it's not zero-sum game. And zero-sum just basically means, if you're looking at a resource that only if you only have two oranges and if you share orange, then you're going to have less. Most, like they said, most game theories or games are not zero-sum. Usually, if you cooperate, there's more for everyone. So it's a very interesting snippet talking about game theory. And like they said, like the backstabbing technique is usually 15th of all the strategies out there. They're also a little bit tit for tats, basically. So if someone does something to you, you retaliate. So it's not all nice guy, but generally you're pushing people to be in game theory to be nice. And if someone acts out of that, you both generally lose in the end. So it's a very interesting theory. It is 8:58 here at WRUV FM Burlington, which means it's almost 9 o'clock, which is time for our news and weather. So the news today is coming from The Cynic, a newspaper that's just down the hallway. And my understanding, if you're a student, you can go join their organization. It's one of the many SGA groups out there that you can join and be active with. And the story that we're covering here is actually another talking about another SGA group. And the headline is Major Political Parties, UVM Chapters Face Extinction. So the student arms of the Democratic and Republican parties have struggled to remain active on campus in recent years. UVM College Democrats have largely been inactive for the past couple of years, said sophomore Merrick Modum, club president. Historically, college Democrats have not had a strong presence at the school, especially within the past few years, Modum said. The group have been suffering from a lack of recruitment and enduring leadership, he said. In recent months, Modum and his friends have been trying to reactivate the organization at UVM, but have struggled with finding enough time to do so, he said. Quote, We've already gone through all the proper mechanisms through the SGA to reactivate it, unquote, Modem said. Modem said that his group is attempting to capitalize on the energy of the upcoming general election. The next step is making sure that we actually can gain members, and then beyond that, stay as an organization beyond just 1 year, he said. The UVM chapter of College Republicans appeared to have been active since the spring of 2022. None of their officers listed on the group's UVM Cubs page are currently students. So go join those. That's one of the clubs you can go out and join and be active with. Including here at WRUV FM Burlington, we're always looking for community members or even students out can obviously be part of the station. And there's a ton of other radio stations out there in the local community that you can be involved with as well. So, like I said, we're probably going to be talking about a lot of those coming up this semester. So, going to go through the weather. And today is Friday, the 24th. And it's going to be mostly clear. There's no chance of snow. The low is going to be 4 degrees Fahrenheit. Tomorrow, which is Saturday, the high is going to be 26 degrees, a low of 21, and it's going to be mostly cloudy. On Sunday, the 26th, it's going to be AM clouds and PM sun. The high is going to be going up, 36 degrees is the high, and the low is going to be 22. And let's reach out to Monday. It's going to be mostly cloudy. The high is going to be 35 degrees. In the Fahrenheit, because we use American units here, and low temperature is going to be 24. So with that, we're going to play you a public service announcement, and then we'll be getting into Einstein's life story. So basically talking about from his early life and some of the basically covering some of the social groups that he was involved with, his friends, and his life story. It's very interesting because most people think he's a solitary genius, but if you really kind of dig into his life story, that's not really the case. His social interactions really formed his ideas and was a positive effect on his life. So I'm just going to go into that. It's very interesting. I'm a physics nerd. I like physics a lot. So very interesting for me about Einstein's story. So we'll get into that. But for now, let's get this public service announcement started.
Thank you so much for tuning in to 90.1 FM Burlington, WRUV. This is a brief message to remind you, someone you know, or a dog you love that might have teeth. Eating processed food causes plaque and tartar to build up around the teeth, behind the gums. By brushing daily, you can avoid nasty diseases like gingivitis that make your gums bleed. So, take time out of your day, enjoy the moment, grab your toothbrush, and brush them clean. You'll be proud of those pearly whites, and glad you did. This message brought to you by the Fresh Breath DJs here at WRUV.
Fresh Breath. Gingivitis. Scary. Okay, here we go. You're listening to WRUV FM Burlington. This is James. Talk show is called Radio Lyceum, if I haven't told you already. Maybe I should give you a little backstory about that. So basically, in collecting the clips for this show, going through Henry David Thoreau's life story. The Lyceum, American Lyceum movement was an interesting turning point in American history. And Henry David Thoreau and Emerson, one of his co-patriots, was heavily involved with the Lyceum movement, was basically a social gathering of people where they would have like public debates, and speakers come, and people would get together and talk about subjects. And their gist was, their main thrust was being extremely worried about the young democracy, because everyone was like, oh, democracy's never going to work. There's too much conflict. There's too many stupid people. They don't know what they're talking about. They don't know what they're voting about. This is a way that people were like, okay, this is so they could bring education out into the public, so people would be informed about what they might be voting on, the issues of the day. People could talk and interact with each other. So that really resonated with me. And something I think is important in bringing back to the community. This is why I call it Radio Lyceum. So without further ado, let's get into Einstein's life story. Crazy hair physicist. One of my favorite people.
Came from a poor medical student who used to dine with his family once a week. Einstein's greatest intellectual stimulation came from a poor medical student who used to dine with his family once a week. It was an old Jewish custom to take in a needy religious scholar to share the Sabbath meal. The Einsteins modified the tradition by hosting instead a medical student on Thursdays. His name was Max Talmud, later changed to Talmi when he immigrated to the United States, and he began his weekly visits when he was 21 and Einstein was 10. Talmud brought him science books, including a popular illustrated series called People's Books on Natural Science, a work which I read with breathless attention, said Einstein. The 21 little volumes were written by Aaron Bernstein, who stressed the interrelations between biology and physics, and he reported in great detail the scientific experiments being done at the time, especially in Germany. In the opening section of the first volume, Bernstein dealt with the speed of light, a topic that obviously fascinated him. Indeed, he returned to it repeatedly in his subsequent volumes, including 11 essays on the topic in Volume 8. Judging from the thought experiments that Einstein later used in creating his theory of relativity, Bernstein's books appear to have been influential. For example, Bernstein asked readers to imagine being on a speeding train. If a bullet is shot through the window, it would seem that it was shot at an angle, because the train would have moved between the time the bullet entered one window and exited the window on the other side. Likewise, because of the speed of the Earth through space, the same must be true of light going through a telescope. What was amazing, said Bernstein, was that experiments showed the same effect no matter how fast the source of the light was moving. In a sentence that, because of its relation to what Einstein would later famously conclude, seems to have made an impression, Bernstein declared, "Since each kind of light proves to be of exactly the same speed, the law of the speed of light can well be called the most general of all nature's laws." In another volume, Bernstein took his young readers on an imaginary trip through space. The mode of transport was the wave of an electric signal. Bernstein was, as Einstein would later be, eager to tie together all of nature's forces. For example, after discussing how all electromagnetic phenomena, such as light, could be considered waves, he speculated that the same may be true for gravity. "A unity and simplicity," Bernstein wrote, "lay beneath all the concepts applied by our perceptions." Truth in science consisted in discovering theories that described this underlying reality. Einstein later recalled the revelation and the realist attitude that this instilled in him as a young boy. "Out yonder, there was this huge world which exists independently of us human beings and which stands before us like a great eternal riddle." Years later, when they met in New York during Einstein's first visit there, Talmud asked what he thought in retrospect of Bernstein's work. "A very good book," he said. "It has exerted a great influence on my whole development." Talmud also helped Einstein continue to explore the wonders of mathematics by giving him a textbook on geometry 2 years before he was scheduled to learn that subject in school. Later, Einstein would refer to it as the sacred little geometry book and speak of it with awe. When Talmud arrived each Thursday, Einstein delighted in showing him the problems he had solved that week. Initially, Talmud was able to help him. but he was soon surpassed by his pupil. After a short time, a few months, he had worked through the whole book, Talmud recalled. He thereupon devoted himself to higher mathematics. Soon the flight of his mathematical genius was so high that I could no longer follow. So the awed medical student moved on to introducing Einstein to philosophy. I recommended Kant to him, he recalled. At that time he was still a child, only 13 years old, yet Kant's works, incomprehensible to ordinary mortals, seemed to be clear to him. Kant became for a while Einstein's favorite philosopher, and his Critique of Pure Reason eventually led him to delve also into David Hume, Ernst Mach, and the issue of what can be known about reality. Einstein preferred to study, based on his own interests and passions, with one or two friends. Even though he was still priding himself on being a vagabond and a loner, he began to hang around the coffee houses and attend musical soirees with a congenial crowd of bohemian soulmates and fellow students. Despite his reputation for detachment, he forged lasting intellectual friendships in Zurich that became important bonds in his life. Among these was Marcel Grossmann, a middle-class Jewish math wizard whose father owned a factory near Zurich. Grossmann took copious notes that he shared with Einstein, who was less diligent about attending lectures. His notes could have been printed and published, Einstein later marveled to Grossmann's wife. When it came time to prepare for my exams, he would always lend me those notebooks, and they were my savior. What I would have done without those books, I would rather not speculate on. Together, Einstein and Grossmann smoked pipes and drank iced coffee while discussing philosophy at the Café Metropole on the banks of the Limmat River. "This Einstein will one day be a great man," Grossmann predicted to his parents. He would later help make that prediction true by getting Einstein his first job at the Swiss Patent Office, and then aiding him with the math he needed to turn the special theory of relativity into a general theory. Because many of the Polytechnic lectures seemed out of date, Einstein and his friends read the most recent theorists on their own. "I played hooky a lot and studied the masters of theoretical physics with a holy zeal at home," he recalled. Among those were Gustav Kirchhoff on radiation, Hermann von Helmholtz on thermodynamics, Heinrich Hertz on electromagnetism, and Boltzmann on statistical mechanics. He was also influenced by reading a lesser-known theorist, August Foppel, who in 1894 had written a popular text titled Introduction to Maxwell's Theory of Electricity. As science historian Gerald Holton has pointed out, Foppel's book is filled with concepts that would soon echo in Einstein's work. It has a section on the electrodynamics of moving conductors that begins by calling into question the concept of absolute motion. "The only way to define motion," Foppel notes, "is relative to another body." From there, he goes on to consider a question concerning the induction of an electric current by a magnetic field. "If it is all the same whether a magnet moves in the vicinity of a resting electric circuit, or whether it is the latter that moves while the magnet is at rest." In his effort to find work in Italy, Einstein enlisted one of the friends he had made while studying in Zurich, an engineer named Michele Angelo Besso. Like Einstein, Besso was from a middle-class Jewish family that had wandered around Europe and eventually settled in Italy. He was 6 years older than Einstein, and by the time they met, he had already graduated from the Polytechnic and was working for an engineering firm. He and Einstein forged a close friendship that would last for the rest of their lives. They died within weeks of each other in 1955. Over the years, Besso and Einstein would share both the most intimate personal confidences and the loftiest scientific notions. As Einstein wrote in one of the 229 extant letters they exchanged, "Nobody else is so close to me, nobody knows me so well, nobody is so kindly disposed to me as you are." Besso had a delightful intellect, but he lacked focus, drive, and diligence. Like Einstein, he had once been asked to leave high school because of his insubordinate attitude. He sent a petition complaining about a math teacher. Einstein called Besso an awful weakling who cannot rouse himself to any action in life or scientific creation, but who has an extraordinarily fine mind, whose working, though disorderly, I watch with great delight. Einstein had introduced Besso to Anna Vintler of Aarau, Marie's sister, whom he ended up marrying. By 1901, he had moved to Trieste with her. When Einstein caught up with him, he found Besso as smart, as funny, and as maddeningly unfocused as ever. He had recently been asked by his boss to inspect a power station, and he decided to leave the night before to make sure that he arrived on time. But he missed his train, then failed to get there the next day, and finally arrived on the third day, but to his horror realizes that he has forgotten what he's supposed to do. So he sent a postcard back to the office asking them to resend his instructions. It was the boss's assessment that Besso was completely useless and almost unbalanced. Einstein's assessment of Besso was more loving. Michele is an awful schlemiel, he reported to Marich, using the Yiddish word for a hapless bumbler. One evening, Besso and Einstein spent almost 4 hours talking about science, including the properties of the mysterious ether and the definition of absolute rest. These ideas would burst into bloom 4 years later in the relativity theory that he would devise with Besso as his sounding board. He's interested in our research, Einstein wrote Marich, though he often misses the big picture by worrying about petty considerations. Besso had some connections that could, Einstein hoped, be useful. His uncle was a mathematics professor at the Polytechnic in Milan, and Einstein's plan was to have Besso provide an introduction. I'll grab him by the collar and drag him to his uncle, where I'll do the talking myself. Besso was able to persuade his uncle to write letters on Einstein's behalf, but nothing came of the effort. Instead, Einstein spent most of 1901 juggling temporary teaching assignments and some tutoring. Zurich, 1909. As a self-assured 17-year-old, Einstein had enrolled at the Zurich Polytechnic and met Mileva Marich, the woman he would marry. Now, in October 1909, at age 30, he was returning to that city to take up his post as a junior professor at the nearby University of Zurich. Their homecoming restored, at least temporarily, some of the romance to their relationship. Marich was thrilled to be back in their original nesting ground, and by the end of their first month there, she became pregnant again. The apartment they rented was in a building where, they happily discovered, Friedrich Adler and his wife lived, and the couples became even closer friends. "They run a bohemian household," Adler wrote his father approvingly. "The more I talk to Einstein, the more I realize that my favorable opinion of him was justified." The two men discussed physics and philosophy most evenings, often retreating to the attic of the three-story building so they would not be disturbed by children or spouses. Adler introduced Einstein to the work of Pierre Duhem, whose 1906 book, La Théorie Physique, Adler had just published in German. Duhem offered a more holistic approach than Mach did to the relationship between theories and experimental evidence, one that seemed to influence Einstein as he staked out his own philosophy of science. Adler particularly respected Einstein's most independent mind. There was, he told his father, a nonconformist streak in Einstein that reflected an inner security, but not an arrogance. "We find ourselves in agreement on questions that the majority of physicists would not even understand," Adler boasted. Einstein tried to persuade Adler to focus on science rather than be enticed into politics. "Be a little patient," he said. "You will certainly be my successor in Zurich one day." Einstein was already assuming that he would move on to a more prestigious university. But Adler ignored the advice and decided to become an editor at the Social Democratic Party newspaper. Loyalty to a party, Einstein felt, meant surrendering some independence of thought. Such conformity confounded him. "How an intelligent man can subscribe to a party, I find a complete mystery," Einstein later lamented about Adler. Einstein was also reunited with his former classmate and note-taker, Marcel Grossmann, who had helped him get his job at the patent office and was now a professor of math at their old polytechnic. Einstein would often visit Grossmann after lunch for help with the complex geometry and calculus he needed to extend relativity into a more general field theory. Einstein was even able to forge a friendship with the other distinguished math professor at the Polytechnic, Adolf Hurwitz, whose classes he had often skipped and who had spurned his plea for a job. Einstein became a regular at the Sunday music recitals at Hurwitz's home, When Hurwitz told him, during a walk one day, that his daughter had been given a math homework problem she did not understand, Einstein showed up that afternoon to help her solve it. As Kleiner predicted, Einstein's teaching talents improved. He was not a polished lecturer, but instead used informality to his advantage. When he took his chair in shabby attire with trousers too short for him, we were skeptical, recalled Hans Tanner, who attended most of Einstein's Zurich lectures. Instead of prepared notes, Einstein used a card-sized strip of paper with scribbles, so the students got to watch him develop his thoughts as he spoke. We obtained some insight into his working technique, said Tanner. We certainly appreciated this more than any stylistically perfect lecture. At each step of the way, Einstein would pause and ask the students if they were following him, and he even permitted interruptions. This comradely contact between teacher and student was, at that time, a rare occurrence, according to Adolf Fisch, another who attended the lectures. Sometimes he would take a break and let the students gather around him for casual conversation. With an impulsiveness and naturalness, he would take students by the arm to discuss things, recalled Tanner. During one lecture, Einstein found himself momentarily stumped about the steps needed to complete a calculation. There must be some silly mathematical transformation that I can't find for a moment, he said. Can one of you gentlemen see it? Not surprisingly, none of them could. So, Einstein continued, then leave a quarter of a page. We won't lose any time. 10 minutes later, Einstein interrupted himself in the middle of another point and exclaimed, I've got it. As Tanner later marveled, during the complicated development of his theme, he had still found time to reflect upon the nature of that particular mathematical transformation. At the end of many of his evening lectures, Einstein would ask,
So, a little side story. This is a very good book, written by Walter Isaacson, called Einstein, His Life and Universe. So it's little snippets from this. So talking about his teaching, well, there's a little bit of debate about how good of a teacher he was. A lot of his lectures were full. So it's a nice little snippet story talking about his interactions with the students. But probably historically, most people consider him as maybe not the best teacher. But his teaching style sounds more up my alley, but that's just me.
Who's coming to the Café Terrasse? There, with an informal cadre on a terrace overlooking the Limmat River, they would talk until closing time. On one occasion, Einstein asked if anybody wanted to come back to his apartment. This morning I received some work from Planck in which there must be a mistake, he said. We could read it together. Tanner and another student took him up on the offer and followed him home. There they all pored over Planck's paper. See if you can spot the fault while I make some coffee, he said. After a while, Tanner replied, You must be mistaken, Herr Professor. There is no error in it. Yes, there is, Einstein said, pointing to some discrepancies in the data, for otherwise that and that would become that and that. It was a vivid example of Einstein's great strength. He could look at a complex mathematical equation, which for others was merely an abstraction, and picture the physical reality that lay behind it. Tanner was astounded. Let's write to Professor Planck, he suggested, and tell him of the mistake. Einstein had by then become slightly more tactful, especially with those he placed on a pedestal, such as Planck and Lorentz. We won't tell him he made a mistake, he said. The result is correct, but the proof is faulty. We'll simply write and tell him how the real proof should run. The main thing is the content, not the mathematics. Einstein had been in Zurich less than 6 months when he received, in March 1910, a solicitation to consider a more prestigious job, a full professorship at the German part of the University of Prague. Both the university and the academic position were a step up. However, moving from the familiar and friendly Zurich to the less congenial Prague would be disruptive for his family. For Einstein, the professional considerations outweighed the personal ones. He was again going through difficult periods at home. The bad mood that you noticed in me had nothing to do with you, he wrote to his mother, who was now living in Berlin. To dwell on the things that depress or anger us does not help in overcoming them. one must knock them down alone. His scientific work, on the other hand, was giving him great pleasure, and he expressed excitement about his possible new opportunity. It is most probable that I will be offered the position of full professor at a large university with a significantly better salary than I now have. When word of Einstein's possible move spread in Zurich, 15 of his students, led by Hans Tanner, signed a petition urging officials there to do your utmost to keep this outstanding researcher and teacher at our university. They stressed the importance of having a professor in this newly created discipline of theoretical physics, and they extolled him personally in effusive terms. Professor Einstein has an amazing talent for presenting the most difficult problems of theoretical physics so clearly and so comprehensively that it is a great delight for us to follow his lectures, and he is so good at establishing a perfect rapport with his audience. The Zurich authorities were so eager to keep him that they raised his salary from 4,500 francs, which was the same as he made as a patent examiner, to 5,500 francs. Those attempting to lure him to Prague, on the other hand, were having a more difficult time. The faculty department at Prague had settled on Einstein as its first choice and forwarded the recommendation to the education ministry in Vienna. Prague was then part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, and such an appointment had to be approved by Emperor Franz Joseph and his ministers. The report was accompanied by the highest possible recommendation from the best possible authority, Max Planck. Einstein's theory of relativity probably exceeds in audacity everything that has been achieved so far in speculative science, Planck proclaimed. This principle has brought about a revolution in our physical picture of the world that can be compared only to that produced by Copernicus. In a comment that might later have seemed prescient to Einstein, Planck added, "Non-Euclidean geometry is child's play by comparison." Planck's imprimatur should have been enough, but it wasn't. The ministry decided that it preferred the second-place candidate, Gustav Jaumann, who had two advantages. He was Austrian, and he was not Jewish. "I did not get the call to Prague," Einstein lamented to a friend in August. "I was proposed by the faculty, but because of my Semitic origin, the ministry did not approve." Jaumann, however, soon discovered that he was the faculty's second choice, and he erupted. "If Einstein has been proposed as the first choice because of the belief that he has greater achievements to his credit," he declared, "then I will have nothing to do with a university that chases after modernity and does not appreciate merit." So by October 1910, Einstein could confidently declare that his own appointment was almost certain. There was one final hurdle also dealing with religion. Being a Jew was a disadvantage. Being a non-believer who claimed no religion was a disqualifier. The empire required that all of its servants, including professors, be a member of some religion. On his official forms, Einstein had written that he had none. "Einstein is as unpractical as a child in cases like this," Friedrich Adler's wife noted. As it turned out, Einstein's desire for the job was greater than his ornery impracticality. He agreed to write Mosaic as his faith, and he also accepted Austro-Hungarian citizenship, with a proviso that he was allowed to remain a Swiss citizen as well. Along with the German citizenship that he had forsaken, but that would soon be foisted back on him, that meant he held, off and on, three citizenships by the age of 32. In January 1911, he was officially appointed to the post, with a pay twice what he had been making before his recent raise. He agreed to move to Prague that March. Einstein had two scientific heroes he had never met, Ernst Mach and Hendrik Lorentz, and he was able to visit them both before his move to Prague. When he went to Vienna for his formal presentation to the ministers there, he called on Mach, who lived in a suburb of that city. The aging physicist and preacher of empiricism who so deeply influenced the Olympia Academy and instilled in Einstein a skepticism about unobservable concepts, such as absolute time, had a gnarly beard and a gnarlier personality. "Please speak loudly to me," he barked when Einstein entered his room. "In addition to my other unpleasant characteristics, I am also almost stone deaf." Einstein wanted to convince Mach of the reality of atoms, which the old man had long rejected as being imaginary constructs of the human mind. Let us suppose that by assuming the existence of atoms in a gas, we were able to predict an observable property of this gas that could not be predicted on the basis of non-atomistic theory, Einstein asked. Would you then accept such a hypothesis? If, with the help of the atomic hypothesis, one could actually establish a connection between several observable properties, which without it would remain isolated, then I should say that this hypothesis was an economical one, Mach grudgingly replied. It was not a full acceptance, but it was enough for Einstein. For the moment Einstein was satisfied, his friend Philip Frank noted. Nevertheless, Einstein began edging away from Mach's skepticism about any theories of reality not built on directly observable data. He developed, said Frank, a certain aversion to the Machist philosophy. It was the beginning of an important conversion. Just before moving to Prague, Einstein went to the Dutch town of Leiden to meet Lorentz. Maric accompanied him, and they accepted an invitation to stay with Lorentz and his wife. Einstein wrote that he was looking forward to having a conversation on the radiation problem, adding, I wish to assure you in advance that I am not the orthodox light quantizer for whom you take me. Einstein had long idolized Lorentz from afar. Just before he went to visit, he wrote a friend, I admire this man like no other. I might say I love him. The feeling was reinforced when they finally met. They stayed up late on Saturday night discussing such issues as the relationship between temperature and electrical conductivity. Lorentz thought he had caught Einstein in a small mathematical mistake in one of his papers on light quanta, but in fact, as Einstein noted, it was simply a one-time writing error, where he had left out a 1.5 that was included later in the paper. Both the hospitality and scientific stimulus made Einstein effusive in his next letter. You radiate so much goodness and benevolence, he wrote, that the troubling conviction that I did not deserve the great kindness and honors could not even enter my mind during my stay at your house. Lorentz became, in the words of Abraham Pice, the one father figure in Einstein's life. After his pleasant visit to Lorentz's study in Leiden, he would return whenever he could find an excuse. The atmosphere of such meetings was captured by their colleague Paul Ehrenfest. The best easy chair was carefully pushed in place next to the large work table for his esteemed guest. A cigar was given to him, and then Lorentz quietly began to formulate questions concerning Einstein's theory of the bending of light in a gravitational field. As Lorentz spoke, Einstein began to puff less frequently on his cigar, and he sat more intently in his armchair. And when Lorentz had finished, Einstein bent over the slip of paper on which Lorentz had written mathematical formulas. The cigar was out, and Einstein pensively twisted his finger in a lock of hair over his right ear. Lorentz sat smiling at an Einstein completely lost in meditation, exactly the way that a father looks at a particularly beloved son, full of confidence that the youngster will crack the nut he has given him, but eager to see how. Suddenly, Einstein's head sat up joyfully. He had it. Still a bit of give and take, interrupting one another, a partial disagreement, very quick clarification, and a complete mutual understanding, and then both men with beaming eyes skimming over the shining riches of the new theory. When Lorentz died in 1928, Einstein would say in his eulogy, I stand at the grave of the greatest and noblest man of our times. And in 1953, for the celebration of the 100th anniversary of Lorentz's birth, Einstein wrote an essay on his importance. Whatever came from this supreme mind was as lucid and beautiful as a good work of art, he wrote. He meant more to me personally than anybody else I have ever met in my lifetime. The Einsteins became acquainted. Einstein had been in Zurich less than 6 months.
listening to WRUV FM Burlington. It's James with Radio Lyceum. You've been listening to Einstein, His Life and Universe by Walter Isaacson. Some of the snippets on Einstein's life, some of interactions with the people that he lived with, and just the general thrust of the whole thing is a little snippet about Einstein and about basically his social interactions, where most people consider him a singular genius. But definitely his social interactions had a great effect on his theories and how he lived his life. So one thing other friends is like, oh, you should definitely throw in talking about his relationship with his wife and how that affected his theory. So in this book, I really didn't cover it. Digging around, I couldn't find much collaborating information about how his wife, like solid information, how his wife influenced his theories. She was a very solid physicist. A lot of people believed she helped a lot with the math in his theories. But without good evidence, couldn't quite put it in there. But there's definitely a lot of conjecture out there that she definitely did have a great influence. Plus, kind of fell outside the theme of what I was going for. But still, I just wanted to make that point. So let's get back into it. Number here is 656-4399.
The Einsteins became acquainted with Berta Fanta, a delightfully cultured woman who hosted at her home a literary and musical salon for Prague's Jewish intelligentsia. Einstein was the ideal catch, a rising scholar who was willing, with equal gusto, to play the violin or discuss Hume and Kant, depending on the spirit of the occasion. Other habitués included the young writer Franz Kafka and his friend Max Brod. Despite the image he sometimes cast as a loner, Einstein continued to establish, as he had back in Zurich and Bern, intimate friendships and emotional bonds, particularly with fellow thinkers and scientists. One such friend was Paul Ehrenfest, a young Jewish physicist from Vienna who was teaching at the University of St. Petersburg, but feeling professionally stymied there because of his background. In early 1912, he embarked on a trip through Europe looking for a new job, and on his way toward Prague, contacted Einstein, with whom he had been corresponding about gravity and radiation. "Do stay at my house so that we can make good use of the time," Einstein responded. When Ehrenfest arrived one rainy Friday afternoon in February, a cigar-puffing Einstein and his wife were at the train station to meet him. They all walked to a café where they compared the great cities of Europe. When Marich left, the discussion turned to science, most notably statistical mechanics, and they continued talking as they walked to Einstein's office. "On the way to the Institute, first argument about everything," Ehrenfest recorded in his diary of the 7 days he spent in Prague. Ehrenfest was a mousy and insecure man, but his eagerness for friendship and his love of physics made it easy for him to forge a bond with Einstein. They both seemed to crave arguing about science, and Einstein later said that, "Within a few hours, we were friends as if nature created us for each other." Their intense discussions continued the next day, as Einstein explained his efforts to generalize his theory of relativity. On Sunday evening, they relaxed a bit by performing Brahms, with Ehrenfest on piano, Einstein on violin, and 7-year-old Hans Albert singing. "Yes, we will be friends," Ehrenfest wrote in his diary that night. "Was awfully happy." Einstein was already thinking of leaving Prague, and he suggested Ehrenfest as a possible successor. "But he adamantly refuses to profess any religious affiliation," Einstein lamented. Unlike Einstein, who was willing to relent and write Mosaic on his official forms, Ehrenfest had abandoned Judaism and would not profess otherwise. "Your stubborn refusal to acknowledge any religious affiliation really bugs me," Einstein wrote him in April. "Drop it for your children's sake. After all, After becoming a professor here, you could revert to this strange hobby horse of yours. Matters eventually came to a happy resolution when Ehrenfest accepted an offer, which Einstein had earlier received but declined, to replace the revered Lawrence, who was cutting back from full-time teaching at the University of Leiden. Einstein was thrilled, for it meant he would now have two friends there to visit regularly. It became, for Einstein, almost a second academic home and a way to escape the oppressive atmosphere he sometimes found in Berlin. Almost every year for the next two decades, until 1933, when Ehrenfest committed suicide and Einstein moved to America, Einstein would make regular pilgrimages to see him and Lawrence in Leiden or the seaside resorts nearby. Dignified and dedicated, Madame Curie was the first woman to win a Nobel Prize. She shared the 1903 Physics Prize with her husband and one other scientist for their work on radiation. 3 years later, her husband was killed by a horse-drawn wagon. She was bereft, and so was her late husband's protege, Langevin, who taught physics at the Sorbonne with the Curies. Langevin was trapped in a marriage with a wife who physically abused him, and soon he and Marie Curie were having an affair in a Paris apartment. His wife had someone break into it and steal their love letters. Just as the Solvay conference was getting underway with both Curie and Langevin in attendance, the purloined letters began appearing in a Paris tabloid as a prelude to a sensational divorce case. In addition, at that very moment, it was announced that Curie had won the Nobel Prize in Chemistry for discovering radium and polonium. Added to her 1903 Physics Prize, she thus became the first person to win Nobels in two different fields. The only other person to do so was Linus Pauling, who won for chemistry in 1954 and then won the 1962 Nobel Peace Prize for his fight against nuclear weapons testing. A member of the Swedish Academy wrote her to suggest that she not appear to receive it, given the furor raised by her relationship with Langevin, but she coolly responded, "I believe there is no connection between my scientific work and the facts of private life." She headed to Stockholm and accepted the prize. The whole furor seemed silly to Einstein. "She is an unpretentious, honest person," he said, "with a sparkling intelligence." More gracious was the sturdy letter of support he sent her later that month. "Do not laugh at me for writing you without having anything sensible to say, but I am so enraged by the base manner in which the public is presently daring to concern itself with you that I absolutely must give vent to this feeling. However, I am convinced that you consistently despise the rabble, whether it obsequiously lavishes respect on you or whether it attempts to satiate its lust for sensationalism. I am impelled to tell you how much I have come to admire your intellect, your drive, and your honesty, and that I consider myself lucky to have made your personal acquaintance in Brussels. Anyone who does not number among these reptiles is certainly happy, now as before, that we have such personages among us as you, and Langevin too, real people, with whom one feels privileged to be in contact. If the rabble continues to occupy itself with you, then simply don't read that hogwash, but rather leave it to the reptile for whom it has been fabricated." Soon, it all worked out. Einstein would move back to Zurich in July 1912. He thanked Zanger for helping him to prevail against all odds and exulted, "I am enormously happy that we will be together again." Marich was thrilled as well. She thought that the return could help save both her sanity and their marriage. Even the children seemed happy to be out of Prague and back to the city of their birth. As Einstein put it in a postcard to another friend, "Great joy about it among us old folks and the two bear cubs." His departure caused a minor controversy in Prague. Newspaper articles noted that anti-Semitism at the university may have played a role. Einstein felt compelled to issue a public statement. "Despite all presumptions," he said, "I did not feel and did not notice any religious prejudice." The appointment of Philipp Frank, a Jew, as his successor, he added, confirmed that such considerations were not a major problem. Then something delightful happened. Albert Einstein, while talking with a friend, took one of the most elegant imaginative leaps in the history of physics. The Step. It was a beautiful day in Bern, Einstein later remembered, when he went to visit his best friend, Michaela Besso, the brilliant but unfocused engineer he had met while studying in Zurich and then recruited to join him at the Swiss Patent Office. Many days they would walk to work together, and on this occasion, Einstein told Besso about the dilemma that was dogging him. "I'm going to give it up," Einstein said at one point. But as they discussed it, Einstein recalled, "I suddenly understood the key to the problem." The next day, when he saw Besso, Einstein was in a state of great excitement. He skipped any greeting and immediately declared, "Thank you, I've completely solved the problem." Only 5 weeks elapsed between that eureka moment and the day that Einstein sent off his most famous paper on the electrodynamics of moving bodies. It contained no citations of other literature, no mention of anyone else's work, and no acknowledgments except for the charming one in the last sentence. "Let me note that my friend and colleague M. Besso steadfastly stood by me in my work on the problem discussed here, and that I am indebted to him for several valuable suggestions." So what was the insight that struck him while talking to Besso? "An analysis of the concept of time was my solution," Einstein said. "Time cannot be absolutely defined, and there is an inseparable relation between time and signal velocity." More specifically, the key insight was that two events that appear to be simultaneous to one observer will not appear to be simultaneous to another observer who is moving rapidly. And there is no way to declare that one of the observers is really correct. In other words, there is no way to declare that the two events are truly simultaneous. His partner. "How happy and proud I will be when the two of us together will have brought our work on the relative motion to a conclusion," Einstein had written his lover, Mileva Maric, back in 1901. Now it had been brought to that conclusion, and Einstein was so exhausted when he finished a draft in June that his body buckled and he went to bed for 2 weeks, while Maric checked the article again and again. Then they did something unusual. They celebrated together. As soon as he finished all four of the papers that he had promised in his memorable letter to Konrad Habicht, he sent his old colleague from the Olympia Academy another missive, this one a postcard signed by his wife as well. It read in full, "Both of us, alas, dead drunk under the table." The E equals MC squared coda. September 1905. Einstein had raised the curtain on his miracle year in his letter to his Olympia Academy mate, Konrad Habicht, and he celebrated its climax with his one-sentence drunken postcard to him. In September, he wrote yet another letter to Habicht, this one trying to entice him to come work at the patent office. Einstein's reputation as a lone wolf was somewhat artificial. "Perhaps it would be possible to smuggle you in among the patent slaves," he said. "You probably would find it relatively pleasant. Would you actually be ready and willing to come? Keep in mind that besides the 8 hours of work, each day also has 8 hours for fooling around, and then there's also Sunday. I would love to have you here." As with his letter 6 months earlier, Einstein went on to reveal quite casually a momentous scientific breakthrough, one that would be expressed by the most famous equation in all of science. "One more consequence of the electrodynamics paper has also crossed my mind. Namely, the relativity principle, together with Maxwell's equations, requires that mass be a direct measure of the energy contained in a body. Light carries mass with it. With the case of radium, there should be a noticeable reduction of mass. The thought is amusing and seductive. But for all I know, the good Lord might be laughing at the whole matter and might have been leading me up the garden path." Einstein developed the idea with a beautiful simplicity. The paper that the Annalen der Physik received from him on September 27, 1905, does the inertia of a body depend on its energy content, involved only three steps that filled merely three pages. The math.
So just cut in, we'll talk about a little about the author of this book, Walter Eickerson. He's a professor of the history at Tulane. He's also author of Leonardo da Vinci, The Innovators, which he had a little stint in a PBS documentary about Leonardo da Vinci, with which was pretty interesting. I would advise you to go check it out. So he also has written a book about Steve Jobs, Benjamin Franklin, American Life, which I've also read. It's a very interesting biography. I might be doing little snippets of that. He's got a wide selection of books, including this one, Einstein, His Life and Universe. So let's get back into it. We got another 10 minutes left, so we got probably, I might throw another two more segments at you, and then we'll won't be back until next week. I might play some music afterwards. I don't know, we'll see how it goes. I really don't have a setup to do DJ mixing here, but we'll give it a shot. So without further ado, let's get back into the story.
When Einstein moved back to Zurich from Prague in July 1912, one of the first things he did was call on his friend Marcel Grossmann, who had taken the notes Einstein used when he skipped math classes at the Zurich Polytechnic. Einstein had gotten a 4.25 out of 6 in his two geometry courses at the Polytechnic. Grossmann, on the other hand, had scored a perfect 6 in both of his geometry courses, had written his dissertation on non-Euclidean geometry, published 7 papers on that topic, and was now the chairman of the math department. "Grossmann, you've got to help me or I will go crazy," Einstein said. He explained that he needed a mathematical system that would express, and perhaps even help him discover, the laws that govern the gravitational field. Instantly he was all afire, Einstein recalled of Grossmann's response. Until then, Einstein's scientific success had been based on his special talent for sniffing out the underlying physical principles of nature. He had left to others the task, which to him seemed less exalted, of finding the best mathematical expressions of those principles, as his Zurich colleague Minkowski had done for special relativity. But by 1912, Einstein had come to appreciate that math could be a tool for discovering, and not merely describing, nature's laws. Math was nature's playbook. The central idea of general relativity is that gravity arises from the curvature of space-time, says physicist James Hartle. Gravity is geometry. I am now working exclusively on the gravitation problem, and I believe that, with the help of a mathematician friend here, I will overcome all difficulties, Einstein wrote to the physicist Arnold Sommerfeld. I have gained enormous respect for mathematics, whose more subtle parts I considered until now, in my ignorance, as pure luxury. Grossmann went home to think about the question. After consulting the literature, he came back to Einstein and recommended the non-Euclidean geometry that had been devised by Bernhard Riemann. Riemann, 1826 to 1866, was a child prodigy who invented a perpetual calendar at age 14 as a gift for his parents and went on to study in the great math center of Göttingen, Germany, under Carl Friedrich Gauss, who had been pioneering the geometry of curved surfaces. This was the topic Gauss assigned to Riemann for a thesis, and the result would transform not only geometry, but physics. The Entwurf and Newton's Bucket, 1913. In May 1913, having discarded the equations derived from the mathematical strategy, Einstein and Grossmann produced a sketchy alternative theory based more on the physical strategy. Its equations were constructed to conform to the requirements of energy-momentum conservation and of being compatible with Newton's laws in a weak static field. Even though it did not seem that these equations satisfied the goals of being suitably covariant, Einstein and Grossmann felt it was the best they could do for the time being. Their title reflected their tentativeness. outline of a generalized theory of relativity and of a theory of gravitation. The paper thus became known as the Entwurf, which was the German word they had used for outline. For a few months after producing the Entwurf, Einstein was both pleased and depleted. "I finally solved the problem a few weeks ago," he wrote Elsa. "It is a bold extension of the theory of relativity, together with the theory of gravitation. Now I must give myself some rest, otherwise I will go kaput." However, he was soon questioning what he had wrought. And the more he reflected on the Entwurf, the more he realized that its equations did not satisfy the goal of being generally or even broadly covariant. In other words, the way the equations applied to people in arbitrary accelerated motion might not always be the same. His confidence in the theory was not strengthened when he sat down with his old friend Michele Besso, who had come to visit him in June 1913 to study the implications of the Entwurf theory. They produced more than 50 pages of notes on their deliberations, each writing about half, which analyzed how the Entwurf accorded with some curious facts that were known about the orbit of Mercury. Since the 1840s, scientists had been worried about a small but unexplained shift in the orbit of Mercury. The perihelion is the spot in a planet's elliptical orbit when it is closest to the Sun, and over the years this spot in Mercury's orbit had slipped a tiny amount more, about 43 seconds of an arc each century, than what was explained by Newton's laws. At first it was assumed that some undiscovered planet was tugging at it, similar to the reasoning that had earlier led to the discovery of Neptune. The Frenchman who discovered Mercury's anomaly even calculated where such a planet would be and named it Vulcan. But it was not there. Einstein hoped that his new theory of relativity, when its gravitational field equations were applied to the Sun, would explain Mercury's orbit. Unfortunately, after a lot of calculations and corrected mistakes, he and Besso came up with a value of 18 seconds of an arc per century for how far Mercury's perihelion should stray, which was not even halfway correct. The poor result convinced Einstein not to publish the Mercury calculations, but it did not convince him to discard his Entwurf theory. Einstein, however, had other reasons to worry in August 1914. His marriage had just exploded. His masterpiece theory still needed work, and now his native country's nationalism and militarism, traits that he had abhorred since childhood, had plunged it into a war that would cast him as a stranger in a strange land. In Germany, it would turn out, that was a dangerous position to be in. World War I. The chain reaction that pushed Europe into war in August 1914 inflamed the patriotic pride of the Prussians, and in an equal and opposite reaction, the visceral pacifism and instinctive nonconformity of Einstein. "Europe in its madness has now embarked on something incredibly preposterous," he wrote Ehrenfest that month. "At such times one sees to what deplorable breed of brutes we belong." Ever since he ran away from Germany as a schoolboy and was exposed to the gauzy internationalism of Jost Winterler in Aarau, but he had generally shunned public activism. World War I changed that. Einstein would never forsake physics, but he would henceforth be unabashedly public for most of his life in pushing his political and social ideals. The irrationality of the war made Einstein believe that scientists, in fact, had a special duty to engage in public affairs. "We scientists, in particular, must foster internationalism," he said. "Unfortunately, we have had to suffer serious disappointments even among scientists in this regard." He was especially appalled by the lockstep pro-war mentality of his three closest colleagues, the scientists who had lured him to Berlin: Fritz Haber, Walter Nernst, and Max Planck. Haber was a short, bald, and dapper chemist who was born Jewish, but tried mightily to assimilate by converting, getting baptized, and adopting the dress, manner, and even pince-nez glasses of a proper Prussian. Even the revered Planck supported what he called Germany's just war. As he told his students when they went off to battle, "Germany has drawn its sword against the breeding ground of insidious perfidy." Einstein was able to avoid letting the war cause a personal rift between him and his three colleagues, and he spent the spring of 1915 tutoring Haber's son in math. But when they signed a petition defending Germany's militarism, he felt compelled to break